Possibility means you have a chance.
Passion opens the door to all possibilities.
When I feel like anything's possible, I feel kind of giddy.
I want to be an astronaut,
an artist,
an actress.
To visit another country.
All I need is a backpack and a pair of shoes and I'll find a way.
That I'm able to do anything I set my mind to.
I've never felt like more things are possible than right now.
In the right shoes, anything's possible.
DSW, countless shoes at brag-worthy prices. Imagine the possibilities.
Is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and I welcome Adrian Wooldridge of The Economist magazine. He is Badgett. At the same time, he is Adrian Wooldridge, author of a new book, The Aristocracy of Talent, How Meritocracy Made the Modern World. Good heavens, this sweeps over an enormous period of history, from kingships reaching back all the way to Plato and then right up till now. Meritocrats is the word. It was invented in the 20th century. But we begin with what Adrian introduces as a ditty from the 19th century to describe the contest for finding why people are elevated and why people are not elevated in human history. It goes like this. God bless the squire and his relations, and keep us in our proper stations. Adrian, good evening and thank you and congratulations. That ditty for me is your book, because the contest against that presumption that there is such a thing as proper stations has informed arguments for, well, at least 2,500 years. Let's begin with where you identify the hierarchical presumption of mankind. How did it work and what was its genesis? What drove it, Adrian? Good evening to you.
John, thank you so much for inviting me. And thank you for starting off with such a profound question, because I think it's important to recognize that for most of human history, the assumptions that we now have about individualism, effort, merit, and reward have not been the assumptions that most people have had. Most people throughout most of history have believed that society is a hierarchy, that people should be born into their proper places, that family connections are more important than individual abilities, and that dynasty rather than individual achievement is the organizing principle of society. And you quoted that wonderful Victorian ditty. You could quote lots of ditties from the 18th century, the 16th century, or before that. And essentially the notion was people inherited their position in the world, that the king was the kingpin of society, that everybody drew their position from their relationship to the king. And that's how things should be. And any deviation from that was regarded as a terrible mistake. Social mobility was something to be feared, avoided, and crushed if it happened.
Walter Raleigh, you quote from the early 17th century, making the case that as nature blesses certain items, such as gems, hath also ordained king. So he was not bothered by what we would consider to be a false comparison. They went searching it with their poetic language for justification. Is that because there was a challenge right away? Why did Raleigh feel compelled to make that remark, given his fate, of course?
Well, I think that he was reflecting the notion of the great chain of being. And that is the notion that everybody and everything in the universe has its proper place ordained by God. So the king is on the throne, the earthworm is burrowing in the ground, and they're all predestined to be doing what they're doing. And you get these marvelous statements by Shakespeare saying that if you fiddle with that order, if you untune that string, as he says in Ulysses, then discord follows. And Walter Raleigh is saying exactly the same thing. He's saying that if you interfere both with the human order and the natural order, which are in many ways manifestations of the same thing, you will cause chaos. And this will be a chaos which is in the natural world as well as in the human world. So you will have thunderstorms, you will have the hurricanes, you'll have massive natural disasters. And of course, his fate is to be executed. And he was, executed for subversion. So he was preaching, you know, the divine order of things, but he was to fall foul of the king and was to be executed.
You mentioned Shakespeare. Is it fair, Adrian, to assume that the mad scene with the storms in Lear is what the 17th and 18th century believed would happen if the king was not obeyed? Is that their vision?
Absolutely. You see this over and over and over again in Shakespeare, that when you have the social hierarchy being threatened and subverted, then you have the natural hierarchy threatened and subverted. So you have storms, you have mental imbalance, you have social imbalance. You see it in Julius Caesar, you see it in Othello, you see it over and over again, that there is a natural order of things ordained by God, and anything that untunes it, as Shakespeare, but anything that disturbs it will be manifested in natural disorder as well as human disorder. And this was an incredibly widely held set of beliefs. And it's a set of beliefs that lasted until relatively recently.
Yes, very recently. We're mentioning dynasty or dynasty, as we in America use that word. And I'm struck by how there was always writers, wise thinkers, observing that kingship was fragile now and again. And you say that diplomacy was mostly dynasty building. They knew that depending upon a family required a lot of hard work. They knew this, Adrian, and it threatened them all the time. Is that correct? They worried about it.
Absolutely. Up until probably the middle of the 19th century, at least, the main institution in most societies in the world is the royal or the imperial dynasty. That's what keeps social order. That's the thing about which society revolves. And this, of course, puts a biological entity at the center of society, that biological entity being a king or a queen or an emperor. And those people are naturally subject to all the sins and the frailties and the problems of humanity. So if you might inherit a throne at the age of 2 years old, as James the Sixth of Scotland did, you might continue to live into your dotage whilst you're still the king or the queen, and you know, continue to have to make decisions when you're long past retirement age. You might go mad. You might be pretty dumb. You might be suffer from temporary madness, like George III, who was lucid some of the time, and very far from lucid the rest of the time. So all of the frailties that human flesh is subject to is put on the throne. And there's also a second complication, which was with women. Women were conceived in these societies as being inferior, and yet, if the daughter is the person who inherits the throne, suddenly you have a woman making all the decisions, like Elizabeth I on the throne, and then she goes from being an inferior person who is meant to bow down to her husband to being essentially the top person in the country and a revered person in the country to whom all men have to bow down. That is an enormous sort of psychological trauma. And, of course, dynasties have to reproduce themselves in order to survive. And that reproduction before modern medicine is an extremely difficult thing. It's very dangerous. Women can die in childbirth. You can have infertility, which means that the dynasty dies out, and then you get civil war between various competing dynasties. And so the urge to create a healthy male son is incredibly powerful. So Henry VIII is, you know, driven to madness, distraction, to murder, in order to get a healthy male son, which he never does.
I want to make
the center of politics.
I want to make note here, because we're going to move beyond nepotism into the absolutist state. I want to make note how I smiled when you quoted Walter Badgett's opinion of every royal house in Europe in 1802 as madness. That's wonderful. Did he get in trouble for saying that?
Well, the extraordinary thing about Walter Badgett, in whose name I write in The Economist, is that he is a conservative who believes that the queen or the king should be on the throne and that they're owed due deference. But he's incredibly contemptuous of these people. He says basically that they're idiots. He says that they should be idiots because nobody with any intelligence could do such a job. And he says that they're essentially decorations who distract the masses from the real rulers of the country, who are the members of cabinet. So he is simultaneously revered by the royal family. I mean, Queen Elizabeth, our current queen, was brought up reading Badgett. But Badgett is saying, look, you're just the equivalent of a spaniel who everybody can look at. And don't get too clever, because you're not meant to be clever. You're just meant to be a fool. So we can all live under the illusion that you make a difference. Well, real clever people like us can make all the decisions.
It's an exciting thing. The book is The Aristocracy of Talent, How Meritocracy Made the Modern World. Adrian Wooldridge is the author. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, visiting with the author, Adrian Wooldridge, who is also Badgett at The Economist magazine. Adrian Wooldridge, his new book is The Aristocracy of Talent, How Meritocracy Made the Modern World. It's incredibly presciently up to date, but we are exploring how we got here. The word meritocracy isn't until the middle of the 20th century. However, the search for who is capable of giving good governance, who can we depend upon, who will live out his reign, includes nepotism, patronage, and venality. And I note, rather than look at the negatives, I want to make clear that there were successes. I wrote down three, Adrian. Thomas Cromwell, Adam Smith. Well, that's enough. Those two would be enough for any country. So patronage and nepotism had its advantages. Was it attractive to the kings? Did it make them worry that they were having to choose people outside of their family for leadership?
Sure. It's very important to remember that in pre-modern society, jobs were not things that individuals earned on merit necessarily. They were things that were given away by the ruling classes through a system of patronage. But the ruling classes quite often give jobs to people who are completely useless. But if they'd only given jobs to people who are completely useless, society would have collapsed. So they also give certain jobs to people who are far from useless, who are extremely good. One classic example of that is Henry VIII, who chooses a succession of lowly born men of extraordinary administrative ability to run his country for him while he's out hunting and womanizing and doing all the things that he likes to do. The first one he chooses is Thomas Wolsey, who is the son of a butcher, who's made his way in the church and who does his job extremely well, although ultimately he fails to get a divorce from Rome, and so he has to be punished by being executed. And then followed by Thomas Cromwell, who, as much as anybody, is the architect of the modern British state in its nascent form. And Cromwell, again, comes from a very humble background. And is a brilliant administrator. He has an encyclopedic knowledge, photographic memory, an extraordinary ability to command documents and to run the country. And again, does Henry VIII fantastic service. And again, ultimately has to be executed. So, and I think quite often kings like to have administrators who are completely dependent on them. Who are poor, who come from a poor background, because they can be dispensed with. They're not a challenge to the king. Everything about them is dependent on the king's majesty.
And we now come to the contradiction inside the royal family, the dynasty, the absolute power. In order to maintain, and Adrian identifies this several ways in several countries in Europe, in order to maintain an absolute estate, you need talent to maintain absolutism. The talent can be ironic. It can be executed, of course, but there's always more of it. I'm struck Adrian, that you've identified several revolutions for merit. Is Napoleon considered a meritocrat? I mean, looking backwards, is that what he was? Because he's a very strange man. He's a combination of several versions of pirate.
Well, Napoleon is an extraordinary figure, and I think more biographies have been written about Napoleon than any other human being, the exception of Jesus Christ, who's slightly more than a human being. And I think that he is such an object of fascination because of the contradictions in Napoleon. On the one hand, he is a meritocrat. He talks about the career open to talent. He comes from a place that's very marginal to France. He comes from Corsica and then moves to Paris. And he makes his way, and his way includes basically becoming the emperor almost of the whole of Europe, on the basis of his extraordinary military and strategic genius. A very minor aristocrat and to the very summit of society. However, he's also has many, many of the prejudices of the aristocracy. He has an instinctive feeling that aristocrats are better. He has an instinctive veneration for monarchy, and he has an instinctive worry about giving too much power to ordinary people. So once he has tamed the revolution, he begins to appoint, he invites the old aristocracy back to France to take up some of its old positions. He begins to give crowns to his own relatives. He becomes an emperor. And so what you get, I think, with Napoleon is a strange merger of these two worlds, of aristocratic privilege on the one hand and of meritocratic self-invention on the other hand. And France, in many ways, is continuing to try and reconcile these two principles. If you look at the current president of France, you know, on the one hand, he's an extraordinary meritocrat, you know, who's risen on the basis of his own talents, extraordinary intellectual abilities. On the other hand, he seems to assume almost the persona of a monarch. You know, the president seems to be a monarch. He has all the glory of a monarch as well. So France has always been caught between these two principles. They, as it were, they got rid of their monarchy and then sort of almost had to psychologically reinvent it in the form of the president.
At this point, the search is, what is the filter, modern metaphor, for good decisions when you pick someone to maintain your absolute estate? And just a note before we break, do I say correctly that somewhere in the 17th and 18th century, the power decided that genius was the filter, brain power, which is what we would say. And did this come from France? Is this the philosophes in action and everybody imitated it? We have about a minute. Absolutely. Before we break. Go ahead.
Absolutely. Suddenly the French in the 18th century fall in love with genius. And they also begin to think that genius is something more than just something that descends on individuals in a sort of fit given to them by God, and is something which is almost a natural phenomenon that some people have by nature, and that the important job that the state can do is to discover genius and give it its appropriate opportunity.
So what we have here is French philosophers giving a methodology to British governance, to eventually American governance, maybe even Frederick the Great's governance. French philosophers saying brain power is what you want to pay attention to. And we're going to turn to what that brain power means in revolution, the French Revolution. Napoleon is a product of that. The American Revolution, the Industrial Revolution in the 19th century, and the Liberal Revolution, especially about education. The book is The Aristocracy of Talent, How Meritocracy Made the Modern World. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, visiting with the author, Adrian Wooldridge, who is also Badgett at The Economist magazine. Adrian Wooldridge, his new book is The Aristocracy of Talent, How Meritocracy Made the Modern World. It's incredibly, presciently up to date, but we are exploring how we got here. The word meritocracy isn't until the middle of the 20th century. However, the search for who is capable of giving good governance, who can we depend upon, who will live out his reign, includes nepotism, patronage, and venality. And I note, rather than look at the negatives, I want to make clear that there were successes. I wrote down three, Adrian. Thomas Cromwell, Adam Smith. Well, that's enough. Those two would be enough for any country. So patronage and nepotism had its advantages. Was it attractive to the kings? Did it make them worry that they were having to choose people outside of their family for leadership?
Sure. It's very important to remember that in pre-modern society, jobs were not things that individuals earned on merit necessarily. They were things that were given away by the ruling classes through a system of patronage. But the ruling classes could quite often give jobs to people who were completely useless. But if they'd only given jobs to people who were completely useless, society would have collapsed. So they also give certain jobs to people who are far from useless, who are extremely good. One classic example of that is Henry VIII, who chooses a succession of lowly-born men of extraordinary administrative ability to run his country for him while he's out hunting and womanizing and doing all the things that he likes to do. The first one he chooses is Thomas Wolsey, who is the son of a butcher, who's made his way in the church, and who does his job extremely well, although ultimately he fails to get a divorce from Rome, and so he has to be punished by being executed. And then followed by Thomas Cromwell, who, as much as anybody, is the architect of the modern British state in its nascent form. And Cromwell, again, comes from a very humble background. And is a brilliant administrator. He has an encyclopedic knowledge, photographic memory, an extraordinary extraordinary ability to command documents and to run the country. And again, does Henry VIII fantastic service. And again, ultimately has to be executed. So, and I think quite often kings like to have administrators who are completely dependent on them. Who are poor, who come from a poor background, because they can be dispensed with. They're not a challenge to the king. Everything about them is dependent on the king's majesty.
And we now come to the contradiction inside the royal family, the dynasty, the absolute power. In order to maintain, and Adrian identifies this several ways in several countries in Europe, in order to maintain an absolute estate, you need talent to maintain absolutism. The talent can be ironic. It can be executed, of course, but there's always more of it. I'm struck, Adrian, that you've identified several revolutions for merit. Is Napoleon considered a meritocrat? I mean, looking backwards, is that what he was? Because he's a very strange man. He's a combination of several versions of pirate.
Well, Napoleon is an extraordinary figure, and I think more biographies have been written about Napoleon than any other human being, the exception of Jesus Christ, who's slightly more than a human being. And I think that he is such an object of fascination because of the contradictions in Napoleon. On the one hand, he is a meritocrat. He talks about the career open to talent. He comes from a place that's very marginal to France. He comes from Corsica and then moves to Paris. And he makes his way, and his way includes basically becoming the emperor almost of the whole of Europe, on the basis of his extraordinary military and strategic genius. A very minor aristocrat and to the very summit of society. However, he's also has many, many of the prejudices of the aristocracy. He has an instinctive feeling that aristocrats are better. He has an instinctive veneration for monarchy, and he has an instinctive worry about giving too much power to ordinary people. So once he has tamed the revolution, he begins to appoints, he invites the old aristocracy back to France to take up some of its old positions. He begins to give crowns to his own relatives. He becomes an emperor. And so what you get, I think, with Napoleon is a strange merger of these two worlds, of aristocratic privilege on the one hand and of meritocratic self-invention on the other hand. And France, in many ways, is continuing to try and reconcile these two principles. If you look at the current president of France, you know, on the one hand, he's an extraordinary meritocrat, you know, who's risen on the basis of his own talents, extraordinary intellectual abilities. On the other hand, he seems to assume almost the persona of a monarch. You know, the president seems to be a monarch. He has all the glory of a monarch as well. So France has always been caught between these two principles. They got rid of their monarchy and then sort of almost had to psychologically reinvent it in the form of the president.
At this point, the search is, what is the filter, modern metaphor, for good decisions when you pick someone to maintain your absolute estate? And just a note before we break, do I say correctly that somewhere in the 17th and 18th century, the power decided that genius was the filter? Brain power, which is what we would say. And did this come from France? Is this the philosophes in action and everybody imitated it? We have about a minute before we break. Go ahead.
Absolutely. Suddenly the French in the 18th century fall in love with genius, and they also begin to think that genius is something more than just something that descends on individuals in a sort of fit given to them by God, and is something which is almost a natural phenomenon that some people have by nature, and that the important job that the state can do is to discover genius and give it its appropriate opportunity.
So what we have here is French philosophers giving a methodology to British governance, to eventually American governance, maybe even Frederick the Great's governance. French philosophers saying brain power is what you want to pay attention to. And we're going to turn to what that brain power means in revolution, the French Revolution. Napoleon is a product of that. The American Revolution, the Industrial Revolution in the 19th century, and the Liberal Revolution, especially about education. The book is The Aristocracy of Talent, How Meritocracy Made the Modern World. This is CBSI on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBSI on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBSI on the World. I'm John Batchelor, speaking with Adrian Wooldridge, the author of the new book, The Aristocracy of Talent. We're going through the several thousand years of the search for talent and the combination of honesty and philosophical thoroughness with the same time of prejudice in everybody who is looking for talent to maintain governance and to achieve prosperity. The blindness of everyone until the 20th century is the mother they've had, the sister they have, and the children they want to have. That's the blindness. And I don't know, other than the fact that I'm sure we're blind to something here in the 21st century, and in the 24th century they will laugh and say something like, can you imagine they thought so well given that they were meat eaters, or something equally unexpected to condemn us. So I'm not seeking to condemn, but Adrian, it is amazing to me now to consider that women did not come to a man called Clever Tom Macaulay, given his genius for reforming the Indian civil service. He did not see his own mother as someone to participate in decision making.
It is absolutely extraordinary that you have these great, great reformers in the middle of the 19th century who develop extremely sophisticated theories of why we should have open competition and why talent is, you know, if not quite democratic, is widely distributed to the population, certainly doesn't just reside with the aristocracy. And it doesn't occur to them to say, well, what about the, and it doesn't occur to them to think, well, wait a minute, my wife, is quite intelligent, or my daughter is quite intelligent. She should be allowed to join in this competition. But here we have one of the paradoxes of meritocracy. There are a lot of people who say, well, the point of meritocracy is that it's just designed by the powerful to preserve their positions. But in fact, what meritocracy does is to open the way for other people to use meritocratic arguments to say, what about me? So women come along and say, well, wait a minute, you argue for open competition. You argue for objective measurements. You argue for examinations. You can't simultaneously make that argument and not allow women to take part. So they don't say get rid of the system. They say make the system work properly. And indeed, you have this extraordinary case in 1892 in Cambridge when a woman called Philippa Fawcett sat the Cambridge Tripos in mathematics. Now, the Cambridge Tripos in mathematics, the Tripos is the final examination in mathematics, was regarded then as the hardest examination in the world, partly because it's intellectually hard, but partly because it's physically very hard because you have a lot of papers which you have day after day after day. And so it's regarded that women are not as clever as men at mathematics and certainly don't have the physical endurance that men have in order to be able to sit these difficult mathematical papers day after day after day after day. And so Philippa Fawcett sits this examination paper and she comes top. And that causes an enormous fuss, both in Cambridge and indeed globally. There's enormous celebration of this amongst progressives globally. But because at that point, women were not allowed to sit the examination, she doesn't get an official classification. She gets the examiner to say she got the best mark, but she's not actually a proper candidate. So she comes, the top candidate, it was called in Cambridge, the senior wrangler. That was this bizarre Cambridge nomenclature for the best mathematician, the senior wrangler. And she was classified as above the senior wrangler, which I think is probably the best classification you could ever have. You're cleverer than the cleverest person in the examination. But this is the paradox of meritocracy, that it actually provides excluded groups, whether they're working class, ethnic minorities, or women or whatever, with the tools that they need to challenge the system and to be rewarded for challenging the system. Philippa Fawcett is one of the classic examples of that.
One of the ironies of the search for talent is that it is the war, the tragedy, the ghastly, inexplicable Great War that opens opportunities for women, because Wilson, Woodrow Wilson, the man of 14 points, can no longer resist the suffragettes in the United States. And I can imagine it was the same in Britain, given how women had participated in sustaining the culture through the Great War. So can we date the recognition of this blindness from the Great War, or did it come later than that? I'm noting Beatrice Webb. I mean, always pay attention to Peter Rabbit. Was that a moment when Webb was participating in these political arguments, or was it the war that opened the road for women to participate in the vote?
Well, Beatrice Webb is one of the architects of Fabianism. Unfortunately, she doesn't write books about rabbits. She writes books about trade unions and local governments and all sorts of rather worthy subjects. But she's a very, very brilliant woman. And she believes very firmly in meritocracy. She wants to create a meritocratic state. And she's one of the founders of London School of Economics. And with her husband, she's an advocate of building a ladder of educational opportunity from the village to the LSE and Oxbridge and the rest, and very influential. She argues over and over again in favor of merit in a very powerful way. And one of the strongest arguments against socialism at that time was that, well, socialism will mean that power is wielded by people who aren't technically qualified. And at least if you've got capitalism, you'll get captains of industry who know how to run companies. And she says, no, that's not the case. In fact, as long as you have meritocracy, the captains of industry can come from the public sector as well as the private sector. And in fact, it means that you won't get the stupid sons of industrialists taking over their power. You'll get jobs running big industries and big corporations given on the basis of examinations. But I would say to your question about the wars, it's not just the First World War, because attitudes that are very deeply ingrained about the mental abilities of women or about the rightness of social deference take an enormously long time to change. The First World War certainly had a big impact and changed the mind of somebody as resistant to change as Woodrow Wilson. But the Second World War, continues this operation. And one of the extraordinary things that happens in the Second World War is that the war is won to a significant degree by superior intelligence. I mean, the intelligence services. If you look at Bletchley Park, over 80% of the people working at Bletchley Park are women. And a lot of the code breakers are women. They don't get as much honor as the men, but they're absolutely vital to the thing. And the way that these women are selected is that they're asked, the country started saying, who can do these crosswords? And they're just asked, people are asked to do crosswords, and they go through the country. They find people who are very good at solving puzzles, women who are very good at solving puzzles. And they say, well, why don't you apply to join this place called Bletchley? They don't really know what they're doing. And then they're bought in. So that's an example of the fact that there was lots of hidden talent in the population, lots of people who didn't think of themselves as intellectual, but were very, very clever, were very good at crosswords or bridge or whatever. And so the state had to build a way of finding these people. They go to Bletchley and they helped to win the war. So the state was forced to use all of the intellectual talents available, women as well as men.
It is extraordinary. We're going to turn to what can go wrong and why with meritocracy, but it is extraordinary to me to read the quotes that you have about how women were dismissed. The one that takes it all is Gustave Le Bon, the Frenchman, who says yes, that women have an incapacity to reason. I wonder what his mother would have thought of him saying that she can't reason.
It is quite extraordinary. And as I say, I was talking about Philippa Fawcett, but Cambridge University, which is a great university, did not give degrees to women until 1948. It's astonishing how long these attitudes
Let us turn to what can go wrong and why in the search for talent. The aristocracy of talent, how meritocracy made the modern world. Adrian Wooldridge. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, speaking with Adrian Wooldridge, who is Badgett for The Economist magazine, but as author, the new book, The Aristocracy of Talent, How Meritocracy Made the Modern World. Adrian's book presents the case for who is best, who is wisest, who is most prosperous, who is a leader. For 2,500 years, from Plato all the way to the 20th century, the 21st century, and yet in the 21st century, starting in the 20th, middle of the 20th, there are doubts about meritocracy, about how it's rendered. And that comes to the invention of the word meritocrat or meritocracy. A man by the name of Young writes a book in the middle of the 19th century that raises these questions, these doubts. And we need to begin there because, as Adrian explicates, this is a criticism that enjoys, in America, we would say bipartisanship. The right at the left, the center, everybody has doubts. And so we go to Michael Young, 1958, Meritocracy. Adrian, what are Michael Young's doubts in the middle of the 20th century? And then we'll examine the rest of the 20th century.
Yeah, in 1958, Michael Young, who is a Labour Party peer eventually, a Labour Party activist, and who is one of the authors of the extraordinary 1945 Labour Manifesto, which helps them to win the landslide victory in 1945. Michael Young writes a book called The Rise of the Meritocracy. And this book basically is a denunciation of the meritocracy. People thought at that time that the left was on the side of meritocracy and that merit was something that the left embraced. In fact, Michael Young says no. And his argument is that meritocracy smuggles in the spirit of competition, smuggles that spirit into the heart of society because it replaces equality of outcome with equality of opportunity. And what it does is to create an intolerable system whereby the successful think that the only reason that they're successful is because they're clever, and therefore that they owe their positions entirely to their own merits, and that the stupid or the less successful, or the people who are left at the bottom of society, have no one to blame for them but themselves and their lack of ability for being at the bottom of society. And so what he's saying is, paradoxically, he's saying, well, aristocracy and the old world of priority, degree, and place may have been awful, but at least the people at the bottom could blame the fact that they were at the bottom on the fact that society was unjust. And the people at the top, the aristocrats, might have a sense, well, they didn't really deserve their position. So they might have a sense of noblesse oblige towards the people at the bottom. So Michael Young is saying the problem with meritocracy is that it works, and it creates, because it works, an intolerable society.
Yes, it's not, IQ tests aren't inaccurate. They're too accurate. It says exactly. My note here, and they create division and alienation. Good heavens, we see enough of that. Now let's begin before Michael Young's book. The predicate for this is already in your reporting. In the 1930s, there is a movement to dismantle 11 plus, already to take it apart, because it was seen as too close to a race science. Also, a man with a wonderful name, sometimes I think Dickens didn't invent very much, because this is a real name, Lancelot Hogban. He believes that IQ is nurture, not nature. And therefore, using an IQ test only gives you something that you'd already known, that those who have the prosperity to be well-educated are going to rise to the top.
Exactly. I mean, one of the most powerful criticisms on the left of meritocracy is it's essentially propaganda for plutocrats, that it just justifies existing inequalities. And the fact that people do well in IQ tests doesn't prove anything about their nature. It doesn't prove that they're by they have greater natural abilities. It just proves that they happen to be born to privileged backgrounds, and they've been well educated, they've been well fed, and well nurtured. And Lancelot Hogban is one of the leading and most interesting advocates of that position. So there is a very profound criticism coming from the left that IQ tests don't measure anything but privilege. And if they just measure privilege, then they're basically, fallacious, that they're basically a lie.
You're right that meritocracy suddenly is a false god. And everyone who had been following this for a hundred years thinking that this could explain the success of the United Kingdom starting in the 19th century, became a world power. The Royal Navy, all of this, it is strange that this argument starts so early. I go now to a political response to meritocracy by the Communist Party, which is vibrant at this time because these are the 1930s and the 1940s, and the Soviets were allies with the United Kingdom until they weren't. What do the Communists say?
Well, the Communist Party is quite interesting on the subject of meritocracy because initially, the Communist Party is very much in favor of meritocracy, and they're initially very much in favor of psychometric tests, IQ tests, and they're even in favor of undoubtedly a foolish science, which is the science of phrenology. So they collect a lot of heads, a lot of skulls, and they collect they put Lenin's skull on display after his death and say, this is a skull of a man with a really big brain. So the communists buy the whole, not just meritocracy, but a lot of pseudoscience like phrenology. And then by the middle of the 1920s, they rapidly change their position. And they say meritocracy is just a capitalist plot, that IQ testing is just part of this capitalist plot, that nature matters much, much more than nurture. And they become the leading critics from a highly egalitarian point of view. Of IQ testing, educational selection, the 11 plus, and all of that, and become doughty warriors for equality of outcome.
The late 20th century sees again and again books that are criticizing the idea that brain power is a quality that we should venerate or trust or follow. We come now to two books that Adrian highlights. I don't know. I know one of them, David Halberstam's Best and Brightest, about the Vietnam War not being the product of Republican populace, but being the best that Harvard intellectuals could do. The second book is more profound, John Rawls' Theory of Justice. But let's begin with David Halberstam. Did it rock the leadership in Europe that Halberstam mocked the decisions of the Vietnam War?
Well, Europe was very ambivalent about the Vietnam War, and many, many people thought that the Vietnam War was just an ill-conceived project. But what was unique about Halberstam's view was that he said that these were the best and brightest. These were the clever people. If you give power to the clever people, the assumption has always been that you get enlightenment and reason and sensible policy. And he says, actually, what you got, because of their very sophisticated theories about dominoes falling, and because of the very strategic advice that they were giving first to Kennedy and then to to LBJ, that you got really, really bad decisions. So that actually the military, which had been much more cautious about Vietnam, were sensible. They might be, you know, they were, might be graduates of football colleges rather than graduates of Harvard, but they had much more common sense. And this was the beginning of a very profound critique of meritocracy, which can be summed up in the old statement that you'd rather trust the first 500 names in the Boston telephone directory than you would trust the entire Harvard faculty. That ordinary people have common sense, and that intellectuals tend to become obsessed by theories, and that those theories can quite often prove to be wrong, as was the case in the Vietnam War, and arguably was also the case in the Iraq War.
More biting is John Rawls' Theory of Justice, 1971, where Mr. Rawls makes the case that it's not hard work, it's not nature, it's not nurture, it's that what we have here is an offense to reason because we need distributive justice. We don't need leadership. What is distributive justice?
Well, what Rawls says is that the notion of merit depends on the notion of desert, that people who work harder and people who are cleverer deserve to get more rewards. And Rawls says that this isn't the case. And it's not the case because the propensity to be clever or the propensity to work hard are things that are inherited. They're actually the result of nature. Rawls is actually very, very much a man who believes in nature rather than nurture. But he says because you inherit your genetically your intelligence, and because you inherit your capacity for hard work, then you don't deserve to be given rewards in excess of other people, except if by giving those rewards, the overall quality of life in the whole of society is improved. So he does accept a certain amount of differentiation, but only if that differentiation could be justified by lifting up the whole boat. And that's a very profound critique, not only of the meritocratic principle, but of the broader sort of American notion that you should have open competition in which the people who get the most rewards keep those rewards as much as possible because they deserve them, because they're the product of their own initiative and intelligence and work and effort. And it's an argument which has had, of course, massive influence over the academy and over the legal system.
The book is The Aristocracy of Talent, How Meritocracy Made the Modern World. Adrian Wooldridge is the author. When we come back, the new nepotism, the new rich, and meritocracy. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Adrian Wooldridge. His book is The Aristocracy of Talent, How Meritocracy Made the Modern World. And the left, or the wise, are, in the late 20th century, doubtful that meritocracy produces results, whether equitable results or even rational results, because we have the new nepotism, described with two family names, Bush and Clinton, the new nepotism. Those are hot topics in the United States. So I want to back up a little bit and talk about the new rich and the old rich. You write cleverly, very cleverly, Adrian, that the new rich require posh surroundings and the old rich require academic degrees. So they share their opinion that we're the elite and we're just going to trade virtues.
Absolutely. I think what one of the things that's happened at the end of the 20th century was that the old rich, which inherited its money, and the new rich, which made its money through intellectual brilliance and academic success, have sort of merged into one. So I say what we have ruling our society at the moment is not a meritocracy, but a plutomeritocracy. And that is a group of people who combine ability with money. But also, if they have money, they buy ability. And if they have ability, they acquire money through success in life. And what they do, this pluto-meritocratic elite at the top of society, is they hoard opportunity. And they hoard opportunity by using their wealth and connections to get their children into the best schools, either private schools or state schools, which function essentially as private schools because they're in the very, very wealthy areas where all the other children go to wealth, are wealthy. And above all, by getting their children into elite universities, which confer status and connections. So what we have now is not the triumph of meritocracy, but the almost the corruption of meritocracy by money. And its manifestations are many, but the one of the manifestations is the return of things that we associate with aristocracy, such as the dynasty. We now have dynasties in America. You have dynasties in America. Nepotism, getting golden opportunities for your relatives. We have that in the United States. And also what I would call a sort of a populist revolt against the elite, because the populist revolt against the elite is predicated on the idea that they're basically aristocrats. They're behaving, they're looking down on us, they're excluding us, they're hoarding privileges. And I think there's an intuition of sense there that this degenerate form of meritocracy is a new aristocracy. It's very different from the old meritocracy that we had after the Second World War.
Globalization, Davos Man, the Cosmos Club, all of that describes a global meritocracy that is now conducting itself without borders. I guess you would have to say meritocrats without borders, all fresh to this. Is that fact, is that enough for the left to turn away from meritocrats? Is that happening now?
Absolutely. What we have at the moment, well, what you had late 19th, early 20th century was the attempt to build a ladder from the local village school to the national elite. And one of the things that's happened is that lots of the rungs of that ladder have been removed. But another thing that's happened is that the ladder needs to be higher, because above the level of the national elite, we're creating a global elite because of global institutions such as the World Bank and the IMF. Global charities, global academic connections, global businesses. This whole world of Davos Man has been constructed. So that's even further away from the ladder of opportunity. And I think that this is something that it's a paradox for the left, because many of the people who are Davos Man, who are at the very top of the pyramid, particularly in the academic world, consider themselves to be leftists. They consider them, you know, a phrase that Thomas Piketty uses to describe them is the Brahmin left. These are sort of Brahmin people who believe that the world should be run by an elite of people like themselves. A more populist sort of left is very critical of these sort of inequalities and of these institutions. But that's also true of the populist right. They're also very critical of these. So I think the left and the right are sort of split between the pluto-meritocratic left and the more populist left, and the same on the right.
I want to turn to the right next, but just a note here, because your governance in the United Kingdom is very exciting for me to learn. Is it significant that there's this assumption that Eton and Oxford go to the head of the class in Parliament? Or is that just something that's just happened recently with Cameron and Johnson? Or is that left over from the old days of assuming that just because you deserve it doesn't mean you're also born to it?
Well, Eden has always been extremely good at training prime ministers. Eden's had more prime ministers than any other school.
Right.
But sudden flourish of prime ministers in years. Boris Johnson is an Etonian. David Cameron is an Etonian. And interestingly enough, Rishi Sunak, who is the Chancellor of the Exchequer, didn't go to Eton, but went to Winchester, which is like Eton for very, very clever people. Another very expensive private school. But I think one of the things that has happened, and I think it's a very interesting development, is that the Eton that we see now is very different from the old Eton. The old Eton used to be a place where the landed elite sent their children, didn't put very much effort on academic ability, except for a small group of scholars, and was basically about playing the game, shaping people's character. But what happened from the 1980s onwards is Eton became a very, very meritocratic institution, very rigorous selection examinations. It became a school for not just posh people, but clever posh people.
The book is The Aristocracy of Talent. Adrian Wooldridge is the author, How Meritocracy Made the Modern World. We're going to turn to criticism of meritocracy from the right, from the populist point of view, and then recommendations here in the early 21st century. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Adrian Wooldridge, the author of The Aristocracy of Talent, How Meritocracy Made the Modern World. We're talking about the governance that it right now has made the world safe in a pandemic. We're talking about the governance that hopes to restore the prosperity that existed before the pandemic. And where did it come from? And is it to be trusted? We've talked about the left starting with doubts in the 1930s, but the right, represented by two events in these last years. One is the Brexit vote in 2015, and the second is the election of a non-politician, Donald Trump of New York, in 2016. This is the populist school, and the populist school has doubts about meritocracy. So, Adrian, let's generalize first. Populism doubts meritocracy because it's made up of experts, because it does not represent common sense. Is that the same in the United Kingdom with the leavers as it is with the Trump voters, we're told, in the United States? Are these the same people?
Absolutely. Absolutely the same people. So it's experts. So in Britain, one of the leaders of the Leave campaign, Michael Gove, said, we've had enough of experts. And the experts got very upset. The notion that they don't have common sense, very much the argument here. And also, both in Britain and the United States, another argument was these people are snobs. They look down on us. They're self-satisfied, they're arrogant, and they look down on us. And I think another important part of the argument was the argument that these people think they're clever, and they're actually not that clever. They're not very good at running the country. So you have a series of catastrophes that have taken place under the aegis of these so-called meritocrats, the most important of which being the financial crisis, which almost brought the world to its knees. And so you see endless similarities between what happened with Brexit and what happened with Trump. But some of the most important are that less educated voters, on the whole, voted for Brexit, as they did for Trump. The people who came from outside the sort of golden triangle, the best connected parts of the country, voted for Brexit and voted for Trump. And the people who voted for Brexit and voted for Trump were very angry and disillusioned with the status quo. And a lot of people, I think, who voted for Brexit didn't actually necessarily think that Brexit would produce a more prosperous society, although they thought it might do. They hoped it might do, but they just wanted to give a kicking to the establishment. They thought the establishment was too effete, too self-satisfied, too smarty-pants, and it needed a jolly good kicking. And I'm sure that that was the case with Trump as well. So very powerful cross-cultural similarities. And you also see the same sort of thing amongst populists right across Europe.
You point to a book, 1995, late 20th century, Christopher Lash, Revolt of the Elites, Betrayal of Democracy. I do not have that book, so I ask you to understand the late 20th century. This is during Clinton's administration. So early on, the right, and it isn't necessarily the Republican Party, but that'll do for generality, saw that what was happening was they were being ignored, that the voters were being ignored. How is this proposed?
Well, Christopher Lash's book is a brilliant book, and he's a very interesting story, really, because he starts off as a Marxist, very much on the left-wing academic, but sort of moves to the right, or at least begins to take the complaints of the right very seriously. And one of his central arguments in this is that the revolt of the elites, it's the elites who turn against patriotism, who turn against nationalism, who turn against religion, and who are in favor of cosmopolitan values, looking down on ordinary Americans from the great heights of their cosmopolitan elitist values. And I think it's a great paradox, because a lot of these, the radicalism of the, let's say, the 1990s was actually led by, you know, by people who were in power, like the Clintons. So they're radicals in power, and they're saying we must dismantle a lot of the inherited structures of the country, classically, flag waving patriotism, religion, and replace them with a new set of liberal values. And that causes a big, populist reaction back in favor of the flag, in favor of religion, in favor of traditional values from people who feel that they're being looked down upon by Harvard, Yale, Stanford, and the rest of these credentialing institutions.
Yes, the diploma democracy and the cognitive elite. In the 2016 campaign, it came down to one word, deplorables. So what we have here is the right picking up early on that there is an elite that is, and we didn't mention it before, this is a left criticism, but I wonder if the right as well, that it marries itself. So it's self-sustaining. There's no social mobility offered.
Well, one of the problems with I argued earlier that one of the problems with the meritocratic elite is it also becomes a plutocratic elite, an elite that sustains itself by using its money to defend itself from outside incursions. And the second part of that is what is called by specialists, by experts, assortative mating. And that is that people who come from this elite marry other people who come from this elite and produce children that they then go on to invest huge amounts of money in training. And the classic example of that, of course, is the Clintons, Hillary and Bill, who not only marry each other and produce a child, Chelsea, who then goes on to have a classic sort of career in philanthropy plus consultancy plus, I think, venture capital of some sort. And that these groups are not true meritocrats. In a true meritocracy, you'll have lots of social mobility. In a true meritocracy, you'll have lots of people falling out of the elite into lower positions. In a true meritocracy, you'll have lots of ways of providing opportunities to the masses in society. What we now have is a degenerate version of meritocracy, a plutocracy with a meritocratic veneer.
The book is The Aristocracy of Talent. Adrian doesn't leave it with describing the problem. He has recommendations. The recommendations are practical and reformist and, of course, utopian all at the same time. So we're going to turn to them when we come back. What is to be done with a meritocracy that at this point is not trusted by either of the energies in political leadership? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and Adrian Wooldridge, his new book is The Aristocracy of Talent, How Meritocracy Made the Modern World. And having described the genius of brain power, finding governance for democracies, for prosperity, for the modern world, we now come up about what is to be done, because the meritocrats have, in some fashion that's very romantic, created a condition that is not unlike royalty or dynasties or hereditary power. So the first thing to do is to describe what we're looking at here is It's a meritocracy, but it's not based on land. Adrian, you report that it's based on information gathering. How so?
The meritocrats are people who can collect and process and command information better than everybody else. And of course, in a society that is in an economy that's based above all on information, these people have enormous amounts of power. They can get this information quickly and they can process it and manipulate it on a global scale. So their power as knowledge workers is like the power of old aristocrats, you know, only more so because it operates on a global scale rather than just on the scale of the local landed estate.
One response is moral, to make a moral argument about what is wrong. At first, I came up against this and I thought, how can you make a moral argument against people who are so well-to-do? What would it look like, Adrian, to remoralize the meritocrats?
Well, what if you think of the origins of meritocracy in the middle of the 19th century in Britain, what you had at that time was not just a technical solution to a problem of how you recruit an elite. You had that. You had the idea that you have open competition and you have examinations. That's a technical solution. But at the same time, you had a moral solution. And the great reformers were saying at that time, the old world is a corrupt world and we need to replace corruption with moral purity. Saying the old world was about self-seeking. We need to create a world in which you have the idea of public service. So these new meritocrats were being trained for public service. They were being trained for duty. And we created a set of institutions such as the public schools and such as Oxford colleges, which were there to inculcate a sense of public obligation and public duty to people. And the great message that they said is if you happen to be born clever and if you happen to have a lot of energy and you happen to be a capable person, that's not just because of you. That's because you've been given certain privileges. And ultimately, it's because you owe duties to God. You know, a very religious sensibility at that time. And so you need to have, you need to give back to society because you've been given so much by society. So and you created, Britain went from being one of the most corrupt countries in the world to being one of the least corrupt countries in the world when it comes to public service because of this notion of public duty. And I think what's happened to the notion of meritocracy during the 20th century, particularly with IQ testing, is it's been demoralized. There's just the notion that you're clever, and because you're clever and hardworking, you deserve certain rewards. And what we need to do is add to that, because you're lucky enough to be clever, and because you're lucky enough to have a work ethic, you actually owe public service to society. So it's not because you're worth it, it's because you actually owe duties to society. So I think that's an area in which we can go back to the original meritocrats and say, what can we learn from you? And what can we learn from Plato, indeed? And what we can learn is that the able owe a duty to society to help to govern it well.
I'm keen on your observations about political meritocracy because it's what you do and it's what I talk to all the time. You identify, and more on this, Adrian, it's wonderful because we're talking about the leading publications of the planet, yours included, The Economist. You say people would rather want to read The Economist and not The Tatler. I read both because I don't get The Tatler and I want to know the jokes. But in any event, I agree with you. We've fallen into, here in the United States, being led by people who are only rewarded for clicks, for clickbait, and not elevating the conversation. Do you believe that at this point, the meritocrats will pay attention if the political meritocracy adjusts itself and starts being more cautious about its generalities?
Well, I think it's got to. I mean, I think we have flirted with disaster, you know, not just because of the global financial crisis, but because of the rise of Trump. We saw the economic system almost melt down. We saw the political system also almost melt down. And we see a massive amount of boiling discontent all the way from the left, from Black Lives Matter to the right and various other sort of groups of people who really want a fundamental change in society. I think that what we need to do is to reform from within, because I think that capitalism is a massive wealth generating machine, because I think that democracy is the best way of organizing the politics of society. But capitalism needs to reform itself. The democratic system needs to reform itself and get rid of a lot of its accretions and corruptions. And I think also meritocracy is the best way of organizing an educational system, an administrative system, but it also needs to make sure that it's not captured by a group of insiders who use it just to benefit themselves. So I think that if we don't have a concerted process of reform, we're in big, big trouble. We flirted with a very serious piece of trouble under Trump. And we have to remember that at the moment, America and the West in general confronts its biggest ever challenge, right, which is China.
Right.
We've never had a country as big and rich and powerful and as attuned to the future as this, staring us down the barrel of a gun. And so we need to rethink a lot of our fundamental principles in order both to reform them so that they're more tolerable at home, but also not to lose what gives us competitive advantage so we can compete abroad.
You have a chapter about China, and we did not go that direction. We've been following the European meritocrat development. But I note here that China, the testing of China, the examination stage you identify in the middle of what we would call pre-enlightenment, do you find echoes of that in the Communist Party today? The idea that you serve the emperor or you serve the party and you are very much tested your whole life as to whether you're adequate, even to the point of almost like being locked in those cells where they tested in the 16th century. Is there an analogy between the two?
Absolutely. Absolutely. China was the country as well that developed the first big mass examination system, which it started developing in the early Middle Ages. It developed a system which tested, you know, from the 9th century onwards, up to 10% of this entire massive country's population, and which allocated positions advising the emperor to the people who did best in the examinations. Then China was testing people for their ability to learn, absorb, and understand the Confucian classics. It was a very classical-based education system, didn't develop. But now we're getting the recreation of this examination state. But this time what they're testing for is your ability to understand science, technology, engineering, biochemistry, and all of these things. So they've linked the examination state not with Confucian texts, but with the various things that are inventing modernity and economic prosperity. And America has never seen a challenge as big as this that is as historically as deeply rooted as this. So America needs to both to purify its own meritocratic systems, but also to reform them in order to be able to take on the challenge that is China.
Specific recommendations by Adrian at the close of his book. We've spoken of the remoralization of the political discourse and individuals who are prosperous, who are successful. But omissions, you say don't fiddle with omissions. That's going on everywhere, Adrian. We see the testing that was the product of the 19th century now dropped. The SAT is no longer regarded as a centerpiece for the next step into higher education. You recommend that is the wrong, that is a poor decision.
It's a very, very poor decision to get rid of SATs because SATs are less gameable than other forms of admissions. You know, you have to select, and I think it's better to select people on the basis of objective tests than it is to do so on the basis of recommendations from their schools, essay performance, personal statements, whether you have a history of doing charitable work and things like that. And that I think America is in danger of moving away from objective measures to measures which actually favor the already privileged. You know, let's take an example, which is personal statements. Personal statements, you know, are going to be things which, I think people who come from privileged backgrounds will necessarily shine at, or they'll get coaching to make sure that they shine at those things. But I think this, I came across an extraordinary figure the other day, which said that at Harvard, 20% of the places are given on the basis of, you know, let's say pure merit, brain power. And the other 80% of the places have some hook attached to them. So a big hook is whether your parents went to Harvard. That's a big advantage. Or whether you are an athletic scholar, whether your parents teach at Harvard, whether you're a music scholar or some other, whether you have some other form of specific hook, or whether you're an affirmative action candidate, whether you have some specific hook. And I think that, you know, it's very odd for people to complain about the problems of meritocracy. The problem is, in many ways, that we don't have a meritocracy. We have a system that is systematically and deliberately biased towards people who bring previous, mostly, in most cases, privileges. So I think that we need meritocracy would be a good idea to try for these elite institutions. So I would say let's purify the system of recruitment. Let's make sure that we do our very best to look for raw talent rather than just good teaching. And that means looking for the hidden Einsteins, the people who are hidden with enormous ability in the, across the population, with the same degree of enthusiasm that we look for great football players, or people with enormous athletic promise, which America is very good looking for. I would say that we need many more academically selective schools to make sure that you can start very, very early in looking for this talent. And one of the, some of the most depressing things, you talked about the SAT tests being removed, but I've also read that in America, they're in Lowell School in San Francisco, which is an academically highly successful school, one of the most successful in the country, which has provided generations of poor immigrants with opportunities. They're replacing a selection on the basis of tests, academic tests, with a lottery. The same is happening at Boston Latin School. How on earth can a lottery be a just way of allocating educational opportunities? How can it be more possible to allocate those opportunities on the basis of a lottery rather than on the basis of tests? I think these are exceptionally dangerous things that America is trying.
The book is The Aristocracy of Talent, How Meritocracy Made the Modern World. Adrian Wooldridge is the author. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
I'm Rodney Williams.
And I'm Travis Holloway. Welcome to The Wealth Break.
Let's be honest. Building wealth doesn't look the same for everyone. It's not just about saving. It's about investing. It's about navigating systems that weren't built for you, embracing your hustle, and relying on your community to create something bigger.
And that's exactly why we created The Wealth Break. We made something different, something more human. It's not just another financial podcast. It's a conversation about real life, real struggles, and real wins.
We're here to talk about the journey. You're here from people who've broken barriers, found creative ways to succeed, and learned to build wealth on their terms. Whether it's the first-time homeowner, a gig worker, or someone turning a side hustle into a six-figure business, we're bringing you their stories.
And we're not stopping at success stories. We're breaking down the realities, like what it means to take risk, how to navigate failure, and why resilience matters. Because wealth isn't about money. It's about creating a life where you can thrive and help others to do the same.
So if you're ready for a podcast as much as about people as it is about money, you're in the right place.
Listen to The Wealth Break podcast on the iHeartRadio app.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code iHeart, or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
We all deserve some yay in our day. So say hello to Hello. Hello makes oral and personal care products that add wonder to your routine, like a toothpaste that makes brushing fun for kids. It's called Unicorn Sparkle Toothpaste. It tastes like rainbows and sunshine, works brilliantly, and it's fun. So it's pretty much magic. And for the adults, Hello Anti-Plaque and Whitening Toothpaste, which is just as good without the unicorns. Visit HelloProducts.com and let Hello add some everyday yay into your life.